Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of December 16th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a decent hour, at a decent hour on a Friday night, is Jim Allen, back from the winter meetings in San Diego. How you doing, bud?
Well, it's a decent hour for you because I've been up for like 30... Well, I haven't quite been up for 37 hours, actually, because I slept on the plane for the first time in my life. Actually, it is good. I am fine. I got like almost 5 hours of sleep on the plane, which is like close to my record.
Yeah, I call that airplane or travel sleep is like fake sleep for me because I can sleep 18 hours on the train. I can't stay awake on moving automobiles or anything.
You got to be inside
transport.
Don't be on the top.
That helps.
That's also a no-no for me. If I'm on top, I'm not sleeping.
Yeah, but once I get off and get on the ground, I'm still sleepy. So it doesn't help me. It's fake sleep. Yeah, for me.
No, this was good. This is like I watch two movies and then okay, that's enough. And then bam, and then I wake up and it's a 2 hours flight time left.
Excellent. Well, we're glad to have you back, and it seems like you had a great time. And we'll get to it on this week's show. We have two talks, one with former Hawks and Eagles pitcher Matt Skrmetta and former Lions and Eagles slugger Jose Mayo Fernandez. And then we're going to look at player movements and handle some high heat and talk about some other stuff. The bases are loaded. Let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
Okay, well, as John mentioned, I was at the baseball winter meetings in San Diego, and this was my sixth baseball winter meetings and my second in
Braggart.
San Diego. Pardon? Yes, absolutely.
Braggart.
I'm bragging. I'm bragging for all I can, man. Was Don Meredith used to say, if you can do it, it ain't bragging.
Okay.
but this is bragging, so okay, we'll put that one on the shelf. Okay. That was the line about former Bay Stars outfielder. I think it was Bill James who said, about Glenn Braggs. He used to play for the Bay Stars and says, well... He had a player comment section, and it said Glenn Braggs, and his first comment was, "Well, tell him to stop."
You can't help
so okay,
it.
Okay. So the winter meetings is great because you get to catch up with a lot of people who you don't get to see. They're all in one place, you know. It depends. It varies from year to year, but between 5 and 8 NPB teams will have some of their international staff there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people to catch up with and so on. And then there's also the people who MLB teams send to Japan on a regular basis. And there's also people working from MLB teams who you know from Japan.
Right.
So it's kind of like a reunion.
I was going to say that.
It is exactly like a reunion that's kind of moving. It's like a... it's like a lot of things, and I'll skip the absurd analogies because they probably aren't any good, but it's just a lot of fun. And so you run into people at random sometimes, and you're trying to arrange things, and everybody's busy, so it's hit and miss and hit and miss. But I hit on enough cylinders this time that it was easily my best winter meetings. And the first one of the real treats was meeting Matt Skrmetta, because I was telling John, and this is the last digression here, that two of the great things about the winter meetings was one day I needed to talk. I felt I needed to talk to the agent for Yosuke Kikuchi, mm-hmm. and there were a couple of other things pending with that discussion, and I knew his name, but I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't have contact information. And just when I was thinking that out loud in a kind of, I guess, psychic way, transmitting those psychic waves to the San Diego evening, I gave up for the night. I was leaving the hotel where the MLB meetings were being held, and walked across the street, and Yosuke Kikuchi's agent walked up and said, "Hey, you're Jim Allen." So that happened, and the next day I was thinking,
you said,
I know, son.
Get away from me, you bother me, kid.
No. But I appreciate people. That happened a weird number of times this year. So I may be on a milk carton or something in America, or a wanted poster, but.
I would vote for the wanted poster, but anyway, go ahead.
Okay. In other words, nobody wants me back. Okay. So the next day it was, I talked to some of the Hawks people, and they told me, Matt Skermet is the guy you want to talk to about that. And I had that sense. I'd read that, and I was interested, and I hadn't seen Matt for a couple of years. And then, okay, I'm gonna take a little trip back to my lodgings and pick up some stuff and come back. And as I'm walking out at the door of the hotel again, there's Matt Skermeta, big as life. And so we had a nice chat. So it was that. So we got Matt, and then the following day, another surprise I didn't expect. Mm-hmm. Another thing I didn't expect was meeting Jose Fernandez, who I haven't seen for about 5 years.
Mm.
And I had no idea he was, he had taken Jose Ortiz's, his former teammate, he's taken his former teammate Jose Ortiz's job as one of the Cebu Lions scouts.
Okay.
So I didn't know that. And when I saw him, I just lit up. And so when you hear me sounding kind of like a fanboy in the interview, cut me some slack. Okay, so let's get on it. Okay, our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is SoftBank Hawks scout and former Hawks and Eagles pitcher Matt Skermeta. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to catch up with you here at the winter meetings in San Diego. Great to see you. Now, tell me, you how many years did you play in Japan?
I only played parts of two seasons. 03, I had surgery in 04 and came back in 05 with Rakuten's first year in 2005. So there's only a little bit of, I would say, a half a season each year.
Okay. Now, if there was, it's kind of brief, but having said that, now you've been a scout with the Hawks for 10 years. So Japanese baseball, despite the short playing career, has been really good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is my 10th year scouting right now and just learning things. Japan's relentless on their work ethic and what they do, so we're continuing to learn every year, and it's been nonstop. So I'm still super happy with SoftBank, and I'm looking forward to learning a whole lot more.
Okay, now let me ask, what were maybe some of the your first impressions, or maybe the shocks coming to Japanese baseball? Because you said you hadn't played overseas before, so you came here, and what was that like?
Yeah, it was really tough on me. I was, I guess, more sheltered coming from America. I didn't leave the country, so this was my first time kind of out of the country, and I was very excited to do it, but ended up, a little homesick, a little scared, lots of anxiety. But, noticing how the Japanese play the game and the Americans play the game and learning a little differences, we had lots of fun in America.
Uh-huh.
We had lots of smiles, lots of jokes. I think it was more about jokes than it was anything else. And then when I came to Japan, it was much more serious, not as many smiles.
Wow.
There was a little bit of, physical, you need to get it right, There's a couple hits.
In the sense that the players were kind of discouraged from being joyful, or if you were being... Did you ever get the idea that if you were having too much fun, maybe people would look askance at that?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I think... you might not be working hard enough if you're enjoying yourself.
Wow.
But, I think over these 10 years, I think that has definitely gotten better, but it's there, it's still around. But we're seeing a little bit more laughter. We had Kawasaki. He was always really fun and loosening up the clubhouse. But, you know, there's some years where you don't have one of those guys. It's a very serious clubhouse and kind of cold.
Okay. Now, you've been a scout. It's your 10th year scouting. And since you started scouting, maybe what is there anything that you, if you think right now, 10 years later, and you think, like, how come I didn't figure this out immediately? How come this took me 10, you know, so X number of years to learn?
Yeah, I think as the older you get, you know, it's easier to be honest or you look a little bit deeper. But, you know, the adjustability part, you know, and I think that was the hardest thing to do is to adjust. And looking back, I wish I would have done, been a little bit softer as far as, or a little bit more open to learning new things.
Okay.
And where now my mind's very open to that. I was very close-minded and a little, like I said earlier, I was scared. I was in a different land, didn't know what was going on. So, you know, and that's why we go to spring training with our new guys and trying to break them in and teach them as much as we can, you know, just so that fear.
When you were starting.
We did not. So, you know, I think, you know, Japanese baseball is getting better and better and better in every field. So
right.
I think we've gone a long ways with interpreters and how to handle Americans.
Right.
And so I think SoftBank does a very good job and lots of other teams as well.
Well, SoftBank's now has got, speaking of open-minded and new things, they got Carter Stewart this past year. He didn't do spring training, but he's going to be in spring training. He's going to be, I'm sure, in the minor league spring training next year. And that's, it's going to be interesting after a few months with the Hawks and then an off-season of work on his own. And I actually heard he's got like a physical, he was given a weight training and fitness routine to take home with him, a little homework.
So
you're going to be eager to see how that pans out.
I am. We're actually going to fly over together. You know, we're going to leave from our same little town in Melbourne and come over there. He's heard a lot about the spring training, but you don't know anything about it until you really feel it or you're in the middle of it. But, you know, he's working really hard this off season, which is something that is new for him. He's always, you know, been young and just talented, but he is doing everything himself. He has his own chef cooking the food for him, and he's really working hard. So we're really excited about spring training. I'm sure they take it a little bit easy on him, try to get him out. I don't think he's going to be doing, you know, 100% of this stuff, but I bet you he'll be doing 75-80% of what the Japanese guys are doing.
But having said that, I just have to ask, is there a little bit in your mind, somewhere in the back of your mind, you're just going to be listening carefully for that first, you got to be kidding me.
And we hear it a lot, but you know, the foreign group that we have right now, we don't hear that
really
at all. You know, but we have very experienced players.
Okay.
So Carter, I don't think he talks enough to do that, but he's complaining now about some of his workouts and the soreness, but I think he's going to have some more coming in spring training. You know, the way they run and what they do. So he's preparing for it, and he's really excited. So.
Well, that's complaining of in a sense. That's a little bit of a complaining in the sense that he's complaining of back issues or kind of thing. So he's got some issues that he's got to deal with. Like us old people.
That's right. And his complaints are more of soreness now and things because he's working so hard. So, but I know he's excited to go to Miyazaki. He's a golfer. He's a very good golfer. And our hotel there is on one of the PGA courses there.
Right.
So we're going to have a little bit of fun on the off days.
Okay. So we'll be looking forward to the off season. And I want to thank you again for joining us and spending this time. It was a real pleasure and an honor.
Thank you so much, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Okay. A blast from the past. Mayo Fernandez. Oh, man.
Hey, Jim. Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's good to see you, brother.
Yeah, I wish we were the ones who had you here. I mean, the Lions brought you in. So you've been scouting with the Lions how long now?
That's correct. This is my second year with them now, scouting internationally. I got the AAA area and then all the Latin American.
And how do you like scouting? Because when you were a player, you were one of the guys –
you were always analytical about the players on your teams, you know, the makeup, how they moved, how they approached the game. You were really on top of that. Was that just a natural extension to go straight into scouting?
I guess so. You know, it's that's been in Japan so long and play for so long, you kind of learn and realize what's the makeup that needs to be in order for you to have success in Japan. And I think that's what was important. And now we're just talking to a couple of the guys about that, how important it is for the guys to come from the U.S. or Mexico or the Dominican or wherever country they're coming from as a foreigner to go to Japan and be successful career over there. So there's a lot of factors, and those that you mentioned are important. I think that will be able to help the guys to be able to have success career in Japan.
Okay, now with the Lions, it's like they want pitchers. So now you're evaluating pitchers. But as a scout, you got to be evaluating pitchers more than just what the balls look like coming to you as a hitter. What has that transition been for you?
Well, the good thing about it is that you have a team.
Right.
So we have a team of scouts. Guys are, you know, that play long time too, and we normally exchange data. One of the it's an easy job actually, because you kind of like.
We didn't hear that. We didn't hear you telling the Lions it's an easy job.
No, I'm talking about it's an easier job to you know examine players. You watch the guys. You see what you like, and then obviously you keep track of them, and then you put them up together. You measure it to the other guys, and everybody sitting table and basically compare data and information, and that's really how you pick your guy. But yeah, it's I don't know, it's a natural thing that comes after you play for so long. You try to visualize it as you're facing this guy, what did he got that you think would get you out when you were in the batter box, and that's the kind of you basically look at and see if it's okay, this guy have enough to get me out, then I think I should go with him.
Okay. All right, well, that's probably sound advice, but everybody could get me out, so you wouldn't get any kind of team. So anyway, I want to ask is, as a scout, one of the jobs, so once your team decides you like a player and you want to talk to them, then your job shifts a little bit to being like an ambassador.
Correct.
And how? I mean, I can see this is a natural for you because you've always been welcoming, open-minded, eager to learn, eager to hear what other people have. So has that been the most enjoyable part of your job?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It is. You helping with your experience, you know, being in Japan for so long and be able to learn the culture and learn the, you know, the mindset that you got to have when you come alone. That's one of the jobs as a scout that you got to have. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, Cebu wanted me to take this job is because, you know, whatever experience we have, we can go and pass it on to the newcomers, which is really, really, it's almost more important than even your skills. You know, like I always tell people, you playing this level, which we look at players, AAA, big league guys, you have the skills, without a doubt. Otherwise, you wouldn't be coming this far in the game. So what we're trying to do now is basically pass it on and see if the makeup of the person, the players, is going to be able to adjust to the culture. It's going to be able to blend in with the guys, understanding, you know, like you say, have an open mind to changes, which I got to have it in order to go to Japan, you know, and do a whole different scenario of the game that you are not used to. So I think that is a big factor. We do take a lot of emphasis into it. And whenever we look at the guy and feel that this is the right guy, then the mental part comes up.
Okay. Now let me ask you, I want to think back on your time in Japan, and as you're playing in America, you still have a deep, even though you're from the Dominican, you're really into, you've developed as a baseball player in America, you live in the heartland, then you go to Japan. How much of that time in Japan, what did it mean to you for your life? I mean, as a person, were the things you learned, oh man, I can't do this, did you change any?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because they tell me they back home they call me Japanese. They don't call me Dominican. And then in America, they say that Japan is my first country, because that's all I do, just talk about the food, talk about the culture, talk about the, you know, the people. And they just like, people are like, you're Japanese now. So I embrace it, and I loved it. And we missed it. Family missed it. They enjoy it. We still stay in touch with a lot of other people. Japanese people are absolutely wonderful in every single aspect. It's always nice to come to this meeting and be able to meet everybody, you know, guys like you that we met for such a long time. And it's a wonderful, it's a wonderful experience because Japanese people are so warm and they always so welcome. And we miss that, absolutely miss that.
There's a really, you know, it varies from person to person about their experience, but there is a difference between the way you're treated as a player coming up in the minors and in the majors and people looking at you and talking to you and coaching you in America than there is in Japan.
Absolutely.
Sometimes warmer, sometimes maybe harder even.
Absolutely. Completely different. And it comes with the culture. I think Japanese, and this is one of the greatest things about the Japanese culture, is they embrace you, they welcome you. You feel welcome. You feel part of that culture. You feel like, man, these guys are working hard. I want to work with them. It's like in our baseball term, you want to go to war with them. It's just, that's just how you make, how they make you feel. It's a job, like it's discipline, which is always important to understand. And if you come down like the way we come up with from the Dominican, you know, how the hard work, you just take pride in what you do, then you just blend right in into the Japanese culture.
Okay, I got one more question then, is do you have any regrets? So when you look back on your time there and you had successes, great successes, and other times when, you know, it's like things aren't going right this year, and do you have any regrets about your time in Japan?
Yeah, I do, actually, that I couldn't stay there 10 more years.
Yeah, okay, all right, buddy, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, guys. I could say it was a pleasure 100 times, and I'd still want to say it 100 more, so I'll just stop and let John talk.
Okay, get a towel and wipe the drool away.
I know. My wife's here looking for, she's looking for a mop and giving me scary looks.
I thought you were going to say she's looking to escape the flood, but anyway. Well, firstly, you know, I have to be quite honest. I don't remember Matt, because part of the time that he was playing here, 2003,
right,
when he was in Fukuoka playing for the Hawks, I was in the States. And then
right,
in 2005, he played for the Eagles. Like he said, not that much, maybe half a season. But the Eagles were pretty awful that year. And back in those days when you and I were covering games on basically a daily basis, either you or I was at a game, we basically focused on the top tier teams. And as I recall, the Eagles won their first game in their history.
They did. And
the next day, I think it was 22-1.
I think it was 28-2 or something, or 28-0.
Or 22-0. I'm not sure.
22. I know Shinsuke Watanabe pitched is what I remember. And
whoever pitched from that time on, they weren't really very relevant. And we basically stayed with the top running team, so we didn't cover them that much. So I ever meet Matt.
I mean, I covered them because, well, I was the senior guy, and I got the couple of trips to Sendai to do I did their home opener,
sure,
and I did their the first interleague game, because they were involved in the interleague story. So okay. I did those two stories.
Okay. But yeah, we spent much of our time, or at least I spent much of my time that year, 2005, avoiding Rakuten, not trying to. But I absolutely love what he said about having fun and smiles among teams. And I think that says a lot about the freedom that I think players have in the States. When you're there, and I've seen it firsthand on the field, the coaches are there to advise when you go to them a lot of times, but they're not standing over or hovering over you like sometimes they are in NPB, making sure those young players are doing the things that they have been asked to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more freedom. In the States, they give you a list of things, and you're expected to do them, and if you don't, you won't play, or you'll get sent down if you're a young player. Mm-hmm. And in NPB, they kind of lord over you and expect you to work very hard at those things and not get in games in some respects if you're a very young player. So I totally understood that. I thought, yeah, having fun and smiling. You see guys, and obviously we haven't seen it in recent years, but you see guys getting a hot foot in the dugout in the States, right? Or you see the guys doing bullpen antics in like in Chicago, they are dancing and putting dance routines together when guys hit home runs and all that stuff. And we just don't see a lot of that in MPB. It's just, and it's not that they're not having fun. I think it's businesslike, and that's part of it, but they are having fun. It just looks different. You know, I think it has a different appearance, and maybe that's part of what Matt was picking up in that,
right.
You know, they're not giving hot foots, but they are enjoying their time. And I think we have to remember that it is a game, and that's the way they treat it. And I, you know, he talked about Muneyori Kawasaki being that kind of player, but I thought we never really saw a lot of that here in Japan. I think when he got over into an environment where, in which that was accepted, then he blossomed in that kind of aspect of his personality came out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm just going to interject here because I had I had the same impression that basically he was just kind of, you know, he was just a team leader. He was just a normal guy, you know, as opposed to a YouTuber and, you know, internet sensation.
Correct.
But people who, I guess people who really, really, really follow the, you know, the Instagram, you know, all the social media and TV that the players go on told me, the Japanese people said, no, he was pretty entertaining, even during his time with the Hawks, I was completely unaware of that.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I was too, and so I think it's there. You know, we just don't always get to see it, and that those things might happen more often in the locker room than out in areas where they can be seen doing those kinds of things, because it would be interpreted differently by media members and by other observers. So I think that's part of it. And while we hope to see Carter Stewart throw next year at some point, either on the farm team, on the second team, or on the top team, I really enjoyed about the portion about the young pitcher's off-season workout situation, since at that moment that I was listening to your talk for the first time, I was at the gym. I was working out, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, I really have to get myself into a situation where I'm really sore today while I'm sitting at a desk at work, because, you know, young Carter is working his butt off so that he can pitch. And so it was inspiring, so to speak. So, yeah, so that was fun.
Right. Well, that was, that was interesting because, oddly enough, one of, you know, working exceedingly hard is one of the things that I know Fernando Seguinol said, even though he was a failure in his first shot at the Oryx Blue Wave. He came back and he reinvented himself. And this is something that we've talked about. I think he told us on the podcast probably 5-6 years ago that he reinvented himself and came back as hired a personal trainer, you know, with all the money that he had after not being, you know, being in the minor leagues for his whole career, for most of his career.
Right.
And getting a guaranteed contract from Japan, and then seeing how people worked, he put, you know, two and two together and says, now I can afford and I could benefit from a personal trainer, and went out through extreme workouts. This is one of the things that people get when they come to Japan, in addition to quizzical looks about why people don't smile.
So what was it that stuck with you?
Well, yeah, that was with Matt, I think it was the bit about, he's in a position now where he's a scout and he's helping people not be him.
And you mean, sir?
Well, I mean is, okay, he played 3 years ago, and he played for 3 years, and he said basically he was a little bit in shock coming to Japan. It was a very hard transition for him. He had never played and he had never played overseas before he came to Japan. And it was hard. He never quite made the transitions he needed to make, but now his job is to find people who often have played abroad and who can make the transitions. And his job is basically, one of his jobs, and this goes for essentially all the foreign NPB scouts, is going to spring training and catching up with the players they've signed and helping them make those adjustments.
Okay.
And so his part of his job is to, yeah, essentially get people to be able to do what he was unable to do. So, which is, I guess, is a sort of a baseball analogy to, if you can't do it, teach it.
Mm-hmm. Those who can't do, teach.
Yeah, those who can't teach. Although some of those who could do teach too, but, you know, Matt failed to make the adjustments. At least he says he failed to make the adjustments, and his career looks like that is probably an accurate representation. So that was the thing I think that what he said was most interesting. Of course, the smiling thing also reminded me of watching the different teams when they come to, they're playing on the road, especially. And I guess the Hanshin Tigers are perhaps the most, I don't want to say the Hanshin Tigers players are uptight, but they're probably the most uptight looking team in NPB.
It's all those almost as PR if guys who
smile,
are there.
Almost as if a smile to the fans who are calling your name as you're walking off the field is punishable. It's a violation of some team rule. Because they're looking at their shoes. They're counting, making sure their shoes are tied as they're walking into the clubhouse.
They have to. Those PR don't guys, they're like, they are the smile police, I bet. I bet they are.
I'll bet. You know, that wouldn't surprise me. Well, I guess the thing for me is that both of these guys, and Matt and I had a long chat before we did the podcast, and then the podcast interview, and Mayo and I had a chat after the podcast interview. But gotcha. Two of the things that really struck me was both of these guys have become just completely enamored of, in Jose's case, it seemed more like Japan in general. Mm-hmm. He just loves Japan, okay? He's from the Dominican Republic. I said he lives in the heartland. He lives in Indianapolis, where he had his longest stretch of his minor league career.
Okay.
And Matt, you know, played briefly, and he loves Japan. He loves, and this is a guy who didn't do really well in Japanese baseball, but he absolutely loves Japanese baseball. And he is also sort of well-known. He's sort of a beacon, a little beacon of Japanese baseball there on the Space Coast in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who knows him has like seen videos of Japanese baseball and how they train and how they work and how they think about the game. And it was just remarkable that these sort of two different viewpoints came out. And both of them are sort of like being referred as to the, like, the neighborhood experts on Japan.
Right.
So that was the thing that got me. I think when I heard Jose sort of say that thing, I was just, my mind was rolling back to, you know, 20 hours earlier when I'd been talking to Matt Skrmetta.
Yeah, I you know, have these vague memories, and basically of him in 2011 after the big earthquake that hit the Fukushima area. He and Brian Sikorsky were driving around the area, because remember that I lived out a little bit closer toward Tokorozawa and the stadium, whatever they're calling it now, Seibu Dome. we don't know what they're calling it in the off season. It's nothing at the moment. It's big airy cold dome. He and Brian Sikorsky were out driving around looking for gas one day, and saw me on the street, and they honked, and they're sticking their heads out the window, and because there was a lot of traffic near every gas station, because there, you know, he was trying to figure out some place to get gas where there wasn't a line. So the memories I have of him at the end there were kind of vague, but you know, he started out with Lotte, he played with Seibu, he played with Rakuten, he played with Oryx as well. So he got
He played for a third of Japan's teams.
Yeah. But remember Bobby Scales on our last show referenced Jose.
He did.
And so it was only fitting that you ran into him and he appears on the show this time. I thought that was really cool. And I really loved his comment about the skills and how everyone basically that teams are interested in, or who these guys who are playing at certain levels have the skills. That's mm-hmm. that's not the real big issue. It's the other things. It's the preparation, the film mm-hmm. work, the practice, the study, the approach, the strategy, the process, and then finally the execution. Those are the things that are going to help these guys make the best of that ability and mm-hmm. then get them over the top and have success in Japan. Because obviously when Bobby talked about the fact that Jose took him aside and said, hey, look, everything you knew about baseball, put it in that trash can over there. I thought that was that was so profound last time. I mean, we had a show. I thought that those words were so profound because we've heard a lot of that from guys who have found success over here. You know, they say, look, it was Jeremy Powell said, look, I had to throw myself a changeup. You know, I had to take what I knew and throw it out. So I thought that was basically the thing that when Jose was talking that really stayed with me after I, you know, like I said, I was at the gym working out, listening to both of these for the first time. But I wanted you to ask him, actually, I don't know when you saw this news come over, but I wanted you to ask him why the Lions signed or decided to re-sign Ernesto Mejia, presumably to sit on the bench again next year. And they also added a guy named Corey Spangenberg, a utility type player. So, I mean, is there a chemistry experiment going on in Tokorozawa, or is there something we don't know about? Because what are they scouting for then if they're going to...
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know. Especially with Corey Spangenberg, it's really... I mean, okay, they have three moves. They had a right-hander, Zach Neale, who was a control right-hander, but seeing Sean Nolan and Zach Neale is sort of like saying, oh, I don't know, they're both in the classifications of guys who don't strike out a lot of batters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their similarity.
Yeah,
now, well, Zach Neale is a subset of those in that he's one of the pitchers who doesn't strike out a lot of batters but never walks any.
Well, yeah, I just wanted you to ask him about that because that seemed...
Right, okay, but that was interesting to me because the next point is, yes, the Ernesto Mejia is an interesting question, and I don't quite know what's going on there other than they value his contributions other than just his offense off the bench. Although they were making noises about... You know, I think maybe the fact that he hit a big pinch hit home run, game-winning home run for them in their pennant drive had some influence, as it does with sports writers and, I guess, some front office people, old-timey front office people.
Right.
But I think if I had a pick, that would be more of a team chemistry kind of a, we value his contribution to the team. The other players.
All right.
But the other one, the Spangenberg, is interesting because the Lions, I think, have the best utility player in NPB right now, who in my opinion, should have won the best nine award at second base, Shuta Tanasaki, because he can play left, he can play right, he can play second, he started playing shortstop, he's played third quite a bit.
But he's not a utility player anymore, he's a starting second baseman, so...
Okay, but no, well, but he didn't play, he didn't start the whole year at second, he still played a bit at third, and I think he might have played a couple of games in the outfield, I recall him, although my memory is not really...
Yeah, well, they did buy themselves a little bit of...
Right, but the point is, they've got another guy who's unlikely to be anywhere nearly as good. He's like sort of like the Shuta Tonosaki backup guy. Of course, Spangenberg also pitched once, so maybe that gives him... ahead, you know, some kind of advantage over Tonosaki, although I don't know.
Well, they already have a backup for Tonosaki, and that's Yuji Kaneko. He can play all over the place. So, yeah.
Right. So that's the look. They're just going for another guy who can play in every position.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So that was kind of interesting. The other one is that Sean Nolan is another, there's another control pitcher on the market who's Mike Bolsinger of the Marines, and In my opinion, I think he would probably have been a better choice but for Nolan, but apparently the Lions were keen on a lefty. I think after Yusei Kikuchi left, they felt left out.
Haha. Gotcha.
Okay, you almost laughed there. I'll take that as a
I knew what you were going for, but you didn't hit the mark. But we're good. It has been some interesting, and we'll get into that section or that segment of the show. In fact, we can go right to it right now and talk about the movers and takers and make a four seam transition and thank both of those guys and you for doing the interviews, and thank you to Jose and to Matt. And hopefully, Matt, when you come to Japan next time, when we can meet up and I can say thank you face to face. But really enjoyed both of those chats, Jim. So thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. So making our four-seam transition. Now, like I said, this is I've titled this segment Movers and Takers. And part of that title is certainly about taking Daisuke Matsuzaka and bringing him back. And that's what Seibu has done. We won't really have time, obviously, to break down every free agent transaction, but I thought, aside from what team decides to bring in the Tsuyoshi Shinjo Circus to its camp, there have been some really eye-catching moves. And I guess the biggest one was this past week when Adam Jones, last with the Arizona Diamondbacks, signed with the Oryx Buffaloes, and that went down on Wednesday here in Japan. And it's a really very impressive acquisition, I think, for the Buffaloes. In fact, our resident Buffalo listener and Twitter follower, Igoru-san, he said, mark my words, it's going to be the year of the Buffaloes in 2020. And so I did mark the words, I noted it, I gave it a like, and I've saved it. And we will talk about it when they win the Japan Series. I can barely say that without laughing.
Hashtag high heat.
Anyway, but I'm just wondering if Adam Jones knows what he's getting into. This is a team
he does. He does.
Yeah.
Well, let's put it this way.
Complex set of bags.
He knows this. He knows okay. Oryx has not done well recently.
Okay.
Because his agent, Nez Bolelo, who's also the agent for Shohei Ohtani, said that. He said that was part of the appeal that they haven't done well recently, because he wants to go in and make a big difference, and no place to make a bigger difference than on a team that needs something more than they had.
That's true.
And of course, there is a blog, a post on my website, which I just sort of went down. What I did, Jones signed a 2-year contract for $8 million with an additional incentives. And so I thought, okay, what players came to Japan for 2 or more years who had hit 100 home runs in the major leagues?
Okay.
I think there were 20. It almost seems like there should be more.
Seems like there should be more, or maybe more. The threshold for home runs should be higher, something like that. Yeah.
Well, the all-time leader in home runs by a major leaguer coming to Japan and playing.
Bob Horner.
No, 2 years. 2 years. Bob Horner was one of those. Bob Horner, the three guys who were really, really big names, major league power hitters: Larry Doby, Bob Horner, and Jose Bautista.
Bautista, yeah.
Were all 1-year guys, although I think Bautista had a longer contract. So Larry Doby with the Chunichi Dragons at the end of his career, and Bob Horner in the middle of his career during collusion, and Jose Bautista after SoftBank bought the Hawks in 2005, were all 1-year guys. So that was the reason they were left out of the study. But the big one was, in fact, in home runs before he came to Japan, was Andrew Jones. But he was 38, you know, so if I asked you, how many home runs did Andrew Jones hit in Japan, would 50 seem like a large number?
Over 2 seasons. Not large, but maybe adequate.
Yeah, adequate. Well, I mean, it seemed like, I'm not certain whether it seemed few or large to me either, but he did hit 50 home runs in his 2 years. And of course, he played a huge leadership role in the Rakuten Eagles, along with a, you know, great offense from the, you know, for their best offensive performer that year, and their and the historic pitching season from Masahiro Tanaka, they won their first and other things. They won their first Pacific League pennant in Japan Series title in 2013. Then I think so. And I asked is would you know I asked Nez if Andrew, Adam Jones was interested in sort of repeating that. And he says, well, look, I don't want to compare. You know, it's actually, I think he said, we're not going to something like throw a Andrew Jones in front of the bus. But Adam Jones is 4 years younger than Andrew Jones was. And he's got a little bit more left in the tank. According to his agent, he has 282 home runs, although Andrew Jones had that many, many, many more than that. But in any case, yes, Adam Jones was aware that Oryx needs some improvement. So if you look on my website, you'll see these lists of players, the youngest to oldest and most home runs in the majors, and I think most home runs in Japan, and so on and so forth. And it's kind of, I thought it was kind of fun. But yeah. The interesting thing was the number one list was Andrew Jones, and Nez said, well, we're not really talking about, we didn't kick, I think he said, we didn't kick around Andrew Jones is the exact language. You'll see that in one of my blogs, you'll see Nez using that phrase. We didn't kick around Andrew Jones. I'm not certain what he meant by that, but he did say we had more in the tank, and that Adam had had a great fire. He had for a long time been interested in Japanese ball. He played against Japan during the 2017 WBC, had a great game when Japan, the United States beat Japan in the semifinal.
Right.
And so it was a really interesting. It's not a huge deal. It is a huge deal for Oryx. And in my impression, this is the first time the Oryx franchise has brought in a huge, a really, really big name major league player.
Yeah, I was going to make that point, and I couldn't remember. I couldn't think of anybody. I mean, Tuffy Rhodes was a guy who built his name up and built his reputation up, even though...
No, Tuffy Rhodes was a 27-year-old...
Right.
Guy who was just, who was just reasserting himself in AAA.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's about it. That's the only real name. I mean,
mind you, they did with Tuffy Rhodes have the most productive foreign hitter ever to come to Japan.
Right.
But in terms of track record,
the reputation preceding him, no,
Oryx has done really, really well with getting guys who were essentially cast-offs. Who were miscast or who were misunderstood or underappreciated in, you know, the guys who were really successful, Tuffy and Greg Boomer Wells. There's a few others, but
Let's move on. Mm-hmm. There's another signing that featured a major league player, a big bopper, in fact, Justin Bour going to Hanshin. Mm-hmm. So it looks like down in the Kansai area, the Kansai Derby is going to be really fun this year with those two guys.
There is. And speaking of guys who were miscast and or underappreciated, one of the Tigers executives, I think it was Mr. Tanimoto, so I think he's the team president and head of baseball operations, said that Justin Bour's swing reminded him of Randy Bass's, because and I think Trevor with the Hanshin Tigers blogger said, way to go, not to put so much pressure on the new guy, but you know, put him in the same group with a 2-time Triple Crown winner.
Yeah, that's going to be tough, but yeah, it reminded him. All right, well, they're both left-handed hitters, so
yep.
All right.
But well, I will not say it was like he's the same kind of player, but I think what he was referring to Bass's ability to hit the ball at Koshien Stadium to left center to keep it the wind from keeping it in the park. The wind off Osaka Bay keeping into the park when it goes out to right. But anyway.
Okay, anyway. I thought that the biggest thing that was interesting, because, I mean, I've seen Bohr. I remember him playing with Miami. I remember him playing, obviously, last year with the Angels, because we were cursed by having to watch him a lot because of Shohei Ohtani, and watching the Angels and them lose on a daily basis almost. But anyway, I thought last year was interesting because Justin Bohr played or appeared in 52 games with the Angels, and he had exactly 52 strikeouts.
Oh. So
I thought that that's really interesting for a guy who, I mean, he hasn't really never hit more than 24 or 25 home runs in any particular season. But he doesn't seem to strike out a lot, so I thought that would be very just something that to keep an eye on when he gets here. Watch and see if he makes a lot of contact. We had the Giants, the Yomiuri Giants, sign Angel Sanchez, who won 17 games over in South Korea last year. And again, like I was saying, there are a whole host of moves. We can't possibly go through them one by one, but I'm just highlighting some of them, and a couple that I thought were interesting. And then one other, Submariner Kazuhisa Makita, formerly of the Lions and with the Padres organization, is coming back to Japan, and he's going to jump over to the Eagles with his buddy Takayuki Kishi and share some mound time over there.
Yeah, so, it's like what have the Eagles done that they need a drain or something? Everything's all our talents flowing out of Tokorozawa
and going to Kazuhisa Ishii.
Maybe that was why they signed him, because
he had dirt
on all these guys or something.
I don't know. Yeah. He's got pictures. It's not just dirt. So those are some of the highlights of some of the players. We've had obviously a number of player movements and team acquisitions of new players and everything, and we'll get to that probably sometime next year when we go through and do our big preview shows, and we'll talk about all the player movements. But those are just some. Now there are still the four players who are going from NPB hoping to go to the major leagues. But have you found it oddly quiet about the entire crop, with the exception of we've heard a little bit of interest in Yoshitomo Tsutsugo over this past week, including some Dodger talk with his name involved, linkage to the Dodgers?
Yes, because none of these guys are the eye-popping, you know, this guy has a potential to be a game changer. Everybody,
certainly, but I didn't expect it to be this quiet. It's like we're in a library. Like there's no noise at all.
With the winter meetings, you never know. Because if basically the noise about posted players starts with when they're posted, and you get a bump,
okay.
You know. So there was noise about these guys. There was noise when there was a buzz when these guys were announced. You know, when the teams confirmed it and that news went out, but. There's a buzz at the winter meetings a little bit. You know, there's a little talk, you know, what do you think about this guy? And that's mostly generated by the Japanese media who attend the meetings. But it's generally then only comes when the guy signs. Now, having said that, that's because none of these guys is a Masahiro Tanaka, Yu Darvish, Daisuke Matsuzaka guy. So that's why. I mean, these are similar to what we get from most of the guys who go, and Tsutsugo's buzz is of course because his posting deadline is the 19th. So that's in days, and it is expected to be. I would be surprised if he has not signed by the time this podcast has gone out.
All right.
He appears.
Was it you who tweeted out that there were three West Coast teams that were?
No, I didn't. It wasn't three West Coast teams.
Or three
No, he had worked out in Southern California, but not for Southern California teams. He was working out at Nolan Arenado's training facility somewhere in Southern California, and that's where he was doing two-hour workout sessions for three different teams, one of which was an American League team, according to his agent, Joel Wolf. And So Tsutsugo appears to be ready to go, ready to sign. But the other guys have been kind of quiet. Akiyama quiet because teams can put Akiyama on the back burner because he's a free agent. He's not under a posting deadline.
Right.
There has been interest in Yusuke Kikuchi, there, according to his agent, Mike Seal. But it's also, there are a few other second basemen on the market, and teams are, Mike has been pushing Kikuchi to be sold as a guy who can play on the left side of the infield, which he did only the briefest amount of times with the Carp as a young player and with the national team when they had trouble fitting him and Tetsuto Yamada into the same infield. But the degree to, you know, and he says, we want to sell, I don't say this, but basically he was positioning Kikuchi as a guy who could play left field if your regular a shortstop if your regular shortstop was on the DL. And I think that is I think he could do it. He's a smart, adaptable guy. I've seen him play shortstop, and he may not have the classic shortstop's arm, but he'll make up for it in other ways. So I think he can do it. But whether teams, you know, is... but that was a question going in with him. So that was that. And then Shun Yamaguchi has been exceedingly quiet about that, which is interesting because I think people see him as the biggest, maybe if not the biggest potential player, the guy with the biggest track record with his career year in NPB, then going straight to the majors. But,
There's not a lot of buzz going on out there.
There was not a lot of buzz. The Toronto Blue Jays were a team that was linked with Tsutsugo. Tsutsugo early, but when I heard their manager saying, basically, we're looking at guys who can add a lot on defense. veteran guys, so they want young guys, selected veteran guys, and guys who can add on defense. I thought, but that was the manager talking. Managers have to win. You know, their focus is all on what they want. The team front office may have a different pool, which is, you know, if Tsutsugo's, give him a chance or whatever. So that I'm not privy to that.
Okay. All right. One note. The major leagues have decided to push ahead with this ridiculous three batter minimum rule for pitchers and.
What do you think about that, John?
That news came out this past week, and we know that the rules that eventually stay in the major leagues end up coming to NPB sooner or later. This rule, what do I think about it? I'm still very much against it. I don't think it actually will speed up the game significantly. It might speed up the overall hours invested as an entire league, but in terms of one particular game here and there, I don't think it's something that it's a mechanism for speeding up the game. In fact, I think it can damage the game and go the other way if you have to leave a pitcher out there who isn't as capable. He ends up giving up more hits or making more pitches, eventually leading to another pitching change. So I don't know. And I also heard Scott Boras interview on one of the ESPN podcasts I listened to, and he brought up a really legitimate concern that the managers might have to leave in a pitcher who maybe, if not injured, is trying to hide an injury. So, he had a typical agent approach to what the rule might do, but I thought it was legitimate in that some guys don't want to come out because they know if they're injured that they might not get another chance, and then they're going to have to stay in and pitch, and that could damage them. And then the next issue is, what does it do to the front offices, the GMs, the people who put together the rosters? So roster construction is going to be affected, and then that trickles down to the players and eventually back to impacting winning and losing, which is what the teams are trying to do. So I just don't think it's a really good idea. I heard someone else say that you're telling people how to manage their team, and that we haven't made so many rule changes to the game that could have a profound impact on how people manage, but this is definitely one of them. I mean, with the recent advent of video replay and expansion of the video replay, we're not changing how people manage. We just change how they approach arguing calls that are questionable. So I'm just not, I hope that this is a trial year and that it fails miserably like I'm imagining that it would, and that they get rid of it, or they allow enough time for these teams to make the adjustments to the rosters so that they can implement this kind of rule or this kind of strategy throughout a season. Because I think everybody's going to have to learn how to do it. So I'm just against it. You?
I'm sort of, I don't see why it can't work. I'm very much, I feel for people who like the game as it is. So, I mean, basketball fans, before they instituted the 24-second shot clock, I'm sure some of them were saying, this is going to radically change the game, and it is. But the point is, this happens. This happens in sports because the people who run the sport have to do quality control. Now, and the purpose of this, and I certainly understand the purpose of this, I'm not certain that this is the way to go at it, but the purpose is basically to say, bringing in one relief pitcher after another is boring.
I got
sorry.
You.
Sorry, it is boring. And as I've said, I don't want to see the guy whose only reason to be on the roster. I do not come to the park hoping to see the lefty whose only purpose in the game is facing one left-handed hitter and wouldn't be on the roster if he didn't pitch left-handed. So I would prefer to see there's a lot of things. Of course, one of the things they could do to eliminate this, which they tried once, and the union basically took MLB's, took their lunch money, was shorten the roster of the roster from 25 to 24. Heck, I'd like to see a 22-man roster. The reason for that is, well, there's fewer player changes. There's more interesting stuff, and you get guys who have to have more different skills.
I agree.
To me, that's much more fun. But,
I agree, but that's my point, is that it changes. You referenced the 24-second clock. That only affects how a coach goes about maybe strategically planning for the game. But a three-batter minimum affects how GMs go about acquiring players.
Again, and so you
I
know
think
what?
It's just I don't a care. Deeper, more profound, intense change, and that's why I'm against it.
I don't
24-second clock situation.
I could care less about how it affects the GM. I'm just anarchist.
But I'm just saying. But that's job. So that's a guy. Yeah, you're saying a guy who maybe isn't as good. A left-hander is not as good against right-handers. Well, that guy, even though he's got quality stuff, is going to be out of work until he learns how to get right-handed guys out.
Right.
In the meantime, are we really making the game faster? Because the guys who are out there now aren't really going to get better at getting right-handed batters out. They're just going to give up hits to them.
Oh, so I don't
it's
care.
It's not really shortening the game.
I'm not interested in shortening the game. I want to get rid of dead time, to be honest. I want to get rid of most of the dead time is created by television. Much of the dead time is created because of television. We can have these long breaks. And another part of the end of the dead time is the fact, and what I'm getting to is that the game, if you don't change the rules, and you just keep the rules the way they are, and you decide we're not going to change them because changing the rules changes the game, it ignores the fact that the game changes on its own. Okay? The game, managers adjust every time somebody has a new way of looking at the rule, essentially finds a loophole in the rule that allows a new strategy or a new tactic to open up. It changes the game. You haven't changed the rule, but the game has changed on its own. That happens all the time. The game also changes because players get bigger and stronger and faster or use more drugs or whatever it is, whatever happens. And, you know, we've seen this in the NFL and the NHL. They've changed the rules. They've changed to alter. They've changed dimensions to essentially to keep the game the same. So what I'm saying is you really want to find what is the best combination of things in the game and then adjust the rules to make sure you keep them that way. I mean, in my case, I'll be really obnoxious and say I would be much happier with many fewer home runs because it... You know, base running and fielding and defense, I think, are a lot more interesting than hitting home runs. But now the question is, how do you go about it? I mean, there are many possible. But the point is not shorten the game, but the okay. And his is where you and I are in agreement. We want to keep the best parts of the game, but I'm less concerned about every part is a part of the game. You know, like pickoff throws. I don't want to see pickoff throws. They're boring. And I don't care. You know, this was an argument against the one-pitch intentional walk. Oh, sometimes they make a mistake. Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often.
Who
All right.
gives? Okay, you know, give me a break. Yeah, give me a break about that one. That's... You know, that's okay. Just silly. But anyway, okay. The point is being is that we want to focus on what the game is and what the game, you know, what's the best part of our game. And just protecting it to say that would change the game is in my opinion, a kind of a weak argument. I mean, if it's just it's going to change the game is a weak argument because the game is going to change on its own without our help.
No,
I know you didn't. I know you didn't.
Okay.
But it develops strategies to deal with the rules, and sometimes you have to say, well, those strategies are not necessarily in the best interest of the game. And in my case, seeing a bunch of gut relievers come parade in to face one batter at a time has nothing to do with what's best for baseball. It's just the way the game is played now, and I would be really happy to get rid of it.
Okay.
That's just me.
Let's go to fielding questions. All right, so the first one is from Mike in D.C. It's an MP3.
Hey, John and Jim. Great work again on another amazing season. You've been talking a lot this year about inconsistent teams, and I'm wondering if there is some sort of inconsistency metric or stat that might exist, something beyond just Pythagorean win shares. If there's not... Might I suggest maybe a team's difference between their average runs scored and allowed versus their mode runs scored and allowed, or like how many runs they score or allow most often? I'd love to see who comes out on top. Thanks.
So I love these mad scientist questions that Mike comes up with, and I think you're just, to me, these are the questions that really get your juices jumping. Or whatever your juices do.
Don't get too specific. My juices don't jump.
So, I think there are a couple ways to interpret this question, but what
yes.
do you think?
Well, I think like hearts and, you know, heart and mind, that consistency is one of those things you just can't measure. Okay. I'm joking. I'm just saying, the fact, I love the question, but I really want to, I don't quite understand which we could interpret it in a couple, in I think two basic ways. Teams that have mood swings or performance swings in hitting and pitching that causes them to be inconsistent. You know, to have inconsistent results over a period of time, or teams that are inconsistent in the sense that they do not, inconsistent in the sense that they don't, their results don't match their game performance. And I'm leaning more towards he's talking about the first one, but I'm not certain. And as far as that goes, I do measure, for example, how much teams' offense varies throughout a season.
Mm-hmm.
How much their runs allowed per game varies throughout the season. But that's important because teams, if you can, and this plays into the way one of the good things about Japanese baseball and small ball is that it ostensibly, or it does improve the number of games in which your team is scoring at least a run.
Right.
You know, because once you score past five runs, you're going to win 95% of your games anyway. Every run doesn't matter as much, so it's just scoring runs isn't in itself the magic bullet. But scoring runs consistently is really valuable, and allowing, you know, a good stable pitching that doesn't allow 10 runs one day, you know, twice a week, is not necessarily the best thing either. So that may be the factor that he's trying to address, and I'm not really. I don't have a good metric, so that's my thing. I wish I did, but I think I need this discussion to go on in a little more. I don't know. I need the parameters or the conditions to be better defined, so we can take a step forward there.
I see.
So please get back to us because I want to move on this one.
Okay. I just go back to Ken Kadokura, the long-faced righty. Dragons, Giants, and somewhere else. I think Yokohama, right before. Yep, before he retired. He said to me one day when I was doing an interview with him, he said there are many ways to enjoy baseball. And, you know, I think it's important to say, because I probably sound like the old man, cane in one hand, snarl on the face, yelling at the young whippersnappers about the numbers. But it doesn't really take a formula to determine when a team stinks to high heaven, or, you know, you could probably predict a lot of times when the team is going to be bad and when the team is going to be good if you just look at the pitchers. I know we want predictors and we want markers and we want all these things to tell us what's going to happen, or when baseball, sports in general, it's the greatest reality TV we can ever watch, because nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. We all think we know what's going to happen, but we watch. We're riveted because we don't know what's going to happen. So it's, you know, they're bad teams because they're bad. Because, you know, I don't need to watch a Rakuten game and see, okay, this pitcher doesn't have as many rotations on his pitches, and that's why he gave up the home run. I can see the location of the pitch. I can see that it wasn't moving very much, and that's why... You know, and the batter was sitting on the pitch, and that's why he got hit out. And then there are other times where you see, a guy make a similar pitch that doesn't get hit out. Yeah, I mean, run differential, average number of runs scored, average number of runs allowed, team ERA, team batting average, errors per game, slugging percentage, OPS, real slugging. I mean, there's a ton of numbers, and we can get into minutia about why these teams are winning and losing, or why there's inconsistency, but I don't think we can predict. You can't predict when a guy's going to make an error on a little one hopper to second base or something. It's just, you know, for me, you just know when you're watching a bad team and you know when you're watching a good one. And, you know, I just don't watch with the assumption that maybe I can figure all this out. And I used to be, when I was really young, I was very scientific about my approach to baseball and how, you know, teams needed to score X number of runs and needed to make X, you know, had to have a certain fielding percentage at each position, particularly up the middle. But I mean, those are things that everybody knows. It doesn't take a genius to sit down and figure out a formula, if there is such a thing. So I don't know. To answer the question, I just don't think there's anything out there that's going to tell you what a bad team is going to look like. But you certainly know the Yakult Swallows were bad last year when you watched them play. Same with the Oryx Buffaloes, and not just because of their results, but because of the process that it took to get to those results. They made mistakes, and you could see them. So, as Jim said, if you give us some more parameters and maybe point out some things, like I said, run all those things that I just mentioned, the OPSs and the runs allowed and run differential and all those things, and see if we can come up with something that might determine.
Yeah, most of the measures we use look at the performance that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it again, understand yeah. how they attributed, you know, how they created value, you know, or how they impacted the game, how those numbers impacted wins and losses is essentially largely what we do. And then, of course, the next step is to find which of those numbers have the most predictive power. In other words, in which of those numbers, which of those measures have the most ability to predict future performance in that area. And I'll give you, just off the top of my head, some that are fairly strong is pitchers' strikeouts and walks, batters' walks and home runs, because they are highly skill dependent.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, for example, batting average or batting average on balls in play, which are far less so. The ability of a player to hit the ball where they ain't is fairly limited. So and there's so many other variables. Well, ones where there are fewer variables have more predictive power. But as far as team consistency, if that's the route this question is going, I wouldn't know. I know one year Bill James sort of like looked at different splits in the majors and decided that veteran, and the ones that were most interesting was that teams with the most veteran teams and the teams with the best bullpens were the most successful in one-run games, but which makes sense. But it was kind of a weak study. It was, it was not a very conclusive thing. So. Predicting team performance based on kinds of splits or things? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, next question came this morning, and it came via Twitter from our buddy Max, from whom we have not heard in quite a long time, so it was great to hear from
you, buddy. That's because when we hear from him, we don't get any gifts.
Okay. His question is, how do you think Yoshitomo Tsugo's numbers translates if he ends up playing with the Los Angeles Dodgers, because they have been rumored to be interested in Tsugo? And he says, obviously, the last thing the Dodgers might need is a left-handed power bat. # high heat.
I have no clue. I am completely... alien to the LA thing.
Okay, well, Tsugo doesn't have speed. I mean, he's a good base runner, but no speed. He doesn't have elite outfield defensive skills, but I don't think he's going to kick the ball over the fence or be a liability.
Okay, hold on. Okay, I want to, and I've been a defender. I've been saying, he's a better outfielder than he looks. Well, that was probably 4 years ago.
I didn't say he was good. I said I'm kick the ball over the fence and be a
no. He's not a foolish. He's very limited in terms. And I don't know if this has been speed or whatnot, but his metrics have been just getting exceedingly bad the last couple of years.
Let me finish before you. Yeah.
Okay. I'll finish before I jump all over you. Okay.
To say.
Okay. having not said nothing to say. Okay, go ahead.
So, but I already think the Dodgers have that player on their roster. His name is Matt Beatty. He is Yoshitomo Tsugo. He's a poor defensive player who could maybe play it in the infield, on a corner infield or in left field. They have a young player named Alex Verdugo, who's a better version of Tsugo, a better outfielder, left-handed, power-hitting outfielder. They have a guy named Carl Garlick, a right-handed batter. So they already have the guy. I don't know if the Dodgers are really interested. And I'm already tossing aside guys like Jock Peterson and Chris Anderson, who played a lot in left field. It's rumored that Jock Peterson might be too expensive and he could be part of a move to get some pitching. So I don't I don't know. And we're not even seeing what young players pop up in camp or the free agent camp invitees. You know, Tsutsugo, he doesn't fit into what I think the Dodgers might be looking for. So that his numbers might translate, if he ends up playing with the Dodgers, to Matt Beatty.
Okay.
That's what I think. But and he doesn't really fit with the Angels. I thought about them as a West Coast American League team. And the Angels already have four DH guys, including Shohei Ohtani. So I don't think he's there. Albert Pujols shouldn't be playing that much in the field. Justin Upton is a DH. And there's probably a guy who's going to show up at camp who's probably DH worthy. So they've got guys already. I don't really think he fits over there either. Although I think the prospects of a Tsutsugo and Ohtani 1-2 punch somewhere in the lineup, maybe 3 or 4 days a week, plus Ohtani on the mound, would be something the Angels could really market and push, and that would be a really big boost. But no, I don't see that working over.
Oh, there's also, I think there was some confusion about the fact of West Coast. There's been no talk that Tsutsugo was particularly linked with West Coast teams. So he was working out in Los Angeles and in Southern California, Los Angeles at UCLA, and then somewhere else in wherever Nolan Arenado has his workout facility in Southern California. But there was no, and he said he didn't have a preference, so I think we can go with that.
Okay. All right, so yeah, it'll be interesting to see where he goes. You say he probably will have signed by the time this comes out, so maybe we'll just have to release this podcast a little bit earlier than scheduled so that he doesn't sign before we come out. But yeah, I'm interested to see where he goes, and yeah, it should be fun to see where the rest of the what the rest of the teams here in Japan do as a reaction to the Adam Jones signing in Oryx with Oryx, because I think some teams are going to have to make some moves and get some players in here to combat that. I think that's a real force for the Buffaloes on paper right now as we sit in December. We have to start the games though, and the real action in late March and in April to see if this is really going to be a force. But great to have you back, Jim. Thank you very much.
Appreciate
Anyone else
it.
Has a question? We appreciate the questions. Max?
Yep.
Max, we love that voice too, buddy. Those MP3s from you, we miss those as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Mike in DC. Anyone else with a question, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions via email to yakyujohn@gmail.com or hit us up on the Facebook page and leave us a comment there. Comments or questions, we take them all. Look for us on iTunes. We will talk to you next time. Enjoy your off season.
And see you at the next winter meetings.